Welcome to our firm. My name's Harmon Spolin. I'm a member here of the Cozen O'Connor Law Firm, and we're delighted to have you here as guest today. It's my pleasure to introduce Robert Spencer, who will discuss his new book, Stealth Jihad, How Radical Islam is Subverting America Without Guns or Bombs. First, a few words about the Middle East Forum, the think tank founded by Daniel Pipes 15 years ago. Professor Pipes is munching on a sandwich at the back of the room. The mission is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and help the United States defend itself at home. Hallmarks of its mission include preventing Tehran from getting nuclear weapons, fighting radical Islam rather than terrorism, and working for Palestinian acceptance of Israel as a Jewish state. I'm sure most of what I've just said you're all familiar with, but it bears repeating always. The forum's projects include several things. The Middle East Quarterly, which is a leading journal on the field. Campus Watch, which exposes problems in Middle East studies. Islamist Watch, which combats nonviolent but radical Islamist activities. The Legal Project, which helps anti-Islamist researchers and activists protect their public freedom of speech. The forum has five websites, which attract over 1 million visitors a month, the highest traffic of any institution in our subject area. Middle East Forum, or MEF, Educational Fund, which supports individuals and smaller organizations working in the field. In addition, today's event is part of a lecture series that the forum presents in five cities. I invite you to add your name to the email list at this event to receive MEF materials. For more information on current activities, please visit the forum's website, which is meforum.org. Of course, I also hope you will consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the forum to continue its work. Before starting, sounds like we're in the movies, but I ask that you all switch off your mobile phones. And please hold your questions and comments until the question and answer session, which Professor Pipes will moderate after Mr. Spencer's formal remarks about our speaker. Robert Spencer is the author of 8 books on Islamist extremism, including the best-selling The Truth About Muhammad, published by Regnery, and The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, also published by Regnery. He writes weekly columns for Human Events and Front Page magazines, and since October 2003 has served as director of jihadwatch.org, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. In Mr. Spencer's new book, Stealth Jihad, How Radical Islam is Subverting America Without Guns or Bombs, Mr. Spencer exposes the nonviolent methods that Islamists use to undermine American society. Noting the success of this strategy in Western Europe, Mr. Spencer offers alternatives so that America, too, is not subverted from within. Stealth Jihad has received praise from such experts as Stephen Emerson, who called it, quote, the definitive book on radical jihadists, and, of course, Daniel Pipes, who declared it a pioneering survey of a phenomenon, quote, whose ambition and subtlety threaten the continuity of Western civilization. Please join me in welcoming Robert Spencer.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here with Daniel Pipes, who's one of the pioneering scholars and investigators on the phenomenon that I call the stealth jihad, and with my colleague Raymond Ibrahim, who in addition to his duties at Middle East Forum also writes with me at Jihad Watch on the web at jihadwatch.org. And the stealth jihad is something that by its very nature, I suppose, and by the name stealth, has eluded the attention of most analysts and policymakers in the United States as well as in Western Europe. The focus has been consistently on terrorism. You may recall during the late presidential campaign that there was actually very little discussion of the question altogether. But when there was, both candidates spoke exclusively about terrorism as such and the need to forestall the next terrorist attack. Now, of course, the importance of that cannot be denigrated or underestimated, and that is a real problem that has to be dealt with. However, to focus exclusively on terrorism is to focus on a tactic rather than upon a real enemy with a real goal that the enemy is trying to implement by means that are much wider than just terrorism alone. Terrorism, in other words, is just one weapon in the arsenal of the group that we are facing, of the Islamic jihadists, who have actually been very articulate and very clear about what they want to do. They do not want to sow undifferentiated mayhem, blow up buildings, bring down airplanes from the sky, simply for the sake of doing so, or for the joy of seeing people that they hate being killed. They actually have a very precise and specific agenda. The most notable engine of this agenda is a group called the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an international Islamic organization which operates in the United States under various names. Most notably, the Muslim American Society, the Islamic Society of North America, Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Circle of North America, and the Muslim Students Association. If you have kept track of these organizations at all over the last few years, then you know that I've just named some of the most prominent, ostensibly moderate Muslim groups in the United States. And yet, the Muslim Brotherhood, according to an internal document that delineated its own strategy for the United States, and which was never intended to be released to the public, but which was captured by law enforcement when they closed down the Holy Land Foundation, which up to a few years ago was the largest Islamic charity in the United States. And now Holy Land Foundation officials have been convicted of funneling charitable donations to the terrorist group Hamas. In any case, among the Holy Land Foundation documents was discovered this strategic outline of the Muslim Brotherhood's goals in the United States, a document dating from 1991 and recording the conclusions of various other meetings dedicated to the same object of delineating the goals of the movement that go back to the early 80s. And in this document, the author of the leader of this meeting of the Muslim Brotherhood explains that the Muslim Brothers in the United States must understand, and I quote, that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and Allah's religion is made victorious over other religions. That's what they want to do. They are going about doing this not only by blowing things up, but by many other means that are also delineated to a great degree in this document. But it's important first to understand the exact nature of the goal itself. When they say Allah's religion is made victorious over other religions, that is not simply a statement of a religious aspiration that everyone would ultimately convert to Islam the way an evangelical Christian might wish that everyone would ultimately convert to Christianity. There are political and societal implications of the idea of Allah's religion being made victorious over other religions that flow from the Muslim Brotherhood's vision and understanding of Islam as inherently political. As a matter of fact, the Brotherhood itself was founded in 1928 in Egypt by Hassan al-Banna, who in his writings explains that one of the main reasons why he was founding the Brotherhood was because the caliphate, the khilafah, had been abolished in Turkey 4 years before, in 1924, at that time, the new secular Turkish government. And he thought that that was an abomination, that it was an insult to Allah, and it was an insult to the Muslims that had to be redressed, because Islam, as he saw it, was inherently political and had a political and societal aspect that indeed was the only perfect and truly good ordering of society, and that ordering was delineated in Islamic Sharia, in Islamic law, that was the only legitimate way for a society to be run, for a government to be run. Now, of course, you're probably all familiar, at least in broad outline, with Islamic law. I should emphasize to you that Islamic law as a body is generally considered by the orthodox authoritative canons of Islamic jurisprudence to be the unalterable law of God, just as much as a pious Jew or Christian would believe the Ten Commandments are the unalterable law of God. You can't have a vote and say, well, I really don't like that eighth one, let's get rid of that one. We'll have a vote, and if most of us want to abolish it, then we'll have something else in its place. That would be unthinkable. And it would be just as unthinkable for a member of the Muslim Brotherhood to have the idea that any of the elements of Islamic law were negotiable or subject to the democratic process. Now, the difficulty with that is that Islamic law encompasses not only individual behavior and acts of piety and how one is to conduct oneself as a Muslim in prayers, in ablutions, in marriage law, and so on, but it is also a political program that, in its fullness, orders every aspect of society and is considered to be applicable not only to Muslims but to non-Muslims as well. And it mandates an institutionalized second-class status for those non-Muslims that is at direct variance with the Western principle arising from the Judeo-Christian tradition of the equality of rights of all people before the law. It mandates the same kind or a similar kind of second-class status for women, denies the freedom of speech, the freedom of conscience, and is at variance with United States constitutional law as well as with the general standards, the general understanding of human rights that has prevailed in the West in recent centuries in numerous ways. That is the law that the Muslim Brotherhood wishes to bring to the West when they say that what we want to do is eliminate and destroy Western civilization from within and make Allah's religion victorious over other religions. That's the goal. Now, how is it proceeding? It is proceeding by means of various initiatives being undertaken by the organizations that I mentioned before, notably the Muslim American Society, the Muslim Students Association, and the others, to insinuate elements of Islamic law, not the whole thing. Obviously, if any of these Islamic groups were to stand up in the public square in America today and say, we want to replace the United States Constitution with Islamic law, then they wouldn't gain any traction whatsoever and would indeed incur quite a bit of suspicion. They're far more clever than that. Their stated goal remaining the same, and remember, it is their stated goal. It's not something that is an invention of mine or anybody else who covers this field. Their stated goal being what it is, they are proceeding very cannily by manipulating various elements of our own societal assumptions, societal traumas, and our own laws as they stand today, such that they are able to insinuate always elements of Islamic law into the United States and assert the principle that where Islamic law and American law conflict, it is American law that has to give way, not Islamic law. Every one of these initiatives taken individually seems like a small thing and is presented as a small thing in the public square and is presented as if it were a mere matter of civil rights or allowing Muslims the free exercise of religion not to be infringed upon as guaranteed by the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And so it seems that anybody who calls attention to these things must be a bigoted paranoid. And yet, there are recurring elements of each of these initiatives which make them a cause for concern, I think, beyond bigotry or paranoia. And that is that they do hit at the idea of equality of rights of all people before the law. And again, invariably, they go back to the Muslim Brotherhood. One of the most notable examples of this is one that Dr. Pipes did so much to bring to national attention, and that was the alcohol in the cabs controversy in Minneapolis. Now, I suspect that since you are members of the Middle East Forum, you're familiar with that in broad outline. So very briefly, I'll just recapitulate what happened. The cab drivers at Minneapolis Airport, who were overwhelmingly Muslim, suddenly announced a few years back that they were not going to carry passengers who had alcohol with them. If you bought a bottle of whiskey in the duty-free shop and went out and you're holding it, they wouldn't take you. Now, this caused people great inconvenience because there were very few non-Muslim cab drivers, and people were waiting for hours to get out of the airport, which I think is a peculiarly painful kind of hell. And so, and someone who is in airports every week, take it from me. In any case, the principle at work was something that goes back to a hadith, a tradition of Muhammad. And remember that in Islamic law, in its classic formulation, Muhammad is the excellent example of conduct. According to the Quran, chapter 33, verse 21, he is the model to be emulated. And so his words and his deeds are normative for Islamic practice. And Muhammad said not only is the Muslim forbidden to drink alcohol, but you can't have anything to do with it. You can't sell it. You can't transport it. Anything that you have to do with alcohol is a grave sin. Now, look, Islamic law, just like all religious law, is one thing, and the way people appropriate it and the way people, how much people pay attention to it, how much people put it into practice is another. And I can testify to you right now that I have on many occasions bought alcohol from Muslims. And they did not hesitate to sell it to me. And I do not think in doing that they thought that they were committing any kind of grave sin. Because there is in Islamic law also, there are actually several principles that in times of necessity, one may set aside the strict letter of the law. In accommodation, when one is a small minority in a non-Muslim polity, one may obey the laws of the land, even if they are at variance with Islamic law. These are things that have been taught widely in American mosques. The first assertion, or the first notable assertion, of the contrary principle, of the idea that no, the idea of equality of treatment, this hard-won victory of the civil rights movement in America, that people have equality of access to services, equality of treatment, without discrimination on the basis of race or religion, that had to be set aside in favor of the obedience to the Islamic principle. This was the first time this was asserted, or one of the first notable times that it was asserted in the cab controversy in Minneapolis. And it marked a notable change. Instead of going along with American law, even where it was at variance with classic Islamic law, for the first time, or one of the first notable times, a Muslim group was asserting that it was American law that had to give way, and that Muslims must be free to discriminate against people on the basis of religion, and refuse to carry passengers who were violating Islamic law. And as Dr. Pipes actually pointed out at the time, once you allow this principle, then you've opened the door to any number of other similar accommodations that could end up being very dangerous. People might say, well, what's the big deal? You know, just get another cab. And actually the airport, before pressure was brought upon them by people who started to understand the principles involved, they were going to go along with this, and they're actually going to color code the cabs. I guess the Sharia cabs would have been green. I don't know what color the other cabs would have been. And you'd have Muslim cabs for people who wanted to obey Islamic law and cabs for people who didn't. And they were saying, well, you know, they're legitimately exercising their religious freedom. But he said, Dr. Pipes, that, okay, so what comes next? If you're carrying a ham sandwich, you can't get in the cab. Or if you have a man and a woman who are unrelated, business partners, colleagues at an office, they can't get in the cab unless they get married. Oriana Fallaci had to marry her translator before she was allowed to interview the Ayatollah Khomeini in the 70s. And so, you know, theoretically, we could see these marriage booths springing up next to the cab stands. But in any case, the principle involved is very clear. And not only that, but as it turned out, this whole thing started, the whole controversy started, because of a fatwa, which of course is a religious decree. A lot of people use the word fatwa as if it means like a contract in a mafia sense, you know? People ask me all the time, have they put out a fatwa on you? As in, you know, do they want to kill you? Well, yes, but it's not a fatwa. A fatwa is just a religious decree that is resolving any disputed question. And so if I don't know if I can use infidel toothbrushes, you know, there's an Islamic toothbrush. If I don't know if it's okay to use an infidel toothbrush, and I go to the imam and say, can I use an infidel toothbrush? His answer, if he relates it to principles of Islamic law as established, then that's a fatwa. And so the Muslim American Society, in this instance, issued a fatwa telling the cab drivers that they couldn't carry passengers with alcohol. And that's where it all started. The Muslim American Society is the principal Muslim Brotherhood organization in the United States. And so is it unreasonable to ask if this whole episode, with all its comic effects and all its ridiculousness, at the same time, is it not an element of this larger effort to eliminate and destroy Western civilization from within? Because after all, it's exploiting the contradictions in American society very skillfully, so that some people think that it's a matter of religious bigotry to oppose what the cab drivers want to do. Some people think that it would infringe upon their religious freedom to restrict what the cab drivers want to do. And then other people are pointing out, well, wait a minute, then we're not treating people equally and not allowing them equal access anymore. And so which principle gives way? And to set up that kind of a conflict, and this is by no means the only example, the book, unfortunately, is full of examples of this kind. To set up this kind of conflict is precisely to weaken the assumptions on which our society is based by sowing this confusion and making it difficult for people to understand why it would be something that would be necessary to resist. I'll give you one other example very briefly before we go to questions, and that is in the meatpacking plants, the Swift meatpacking plants in Nebraska and Colorado, same situation. The Muslim workers, overwhelmingly Muslim employee base, and the Muslim workers asked for, actually in this case they very shrilly demanded, that they be granted during Ramadan, the month of fasting for Muslims, that they be granted a special break time so they could break the fast at the proper time. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission allows for reasonable, actually mandates, reasonable accommodation of particular religious practices, practiced by religious minorities. And so it seems like a clear-cut case. And the Swift officials in both plants immediately granted it. And they granted a special break time. If you were a Muslim, you could take a break at 7 o'clock, and if you were a non-Muslim, then you take the break at 9 o'clock, or what have you. What happened next, nobody foresaw. The non-Muslim employees in both plants protested and said, now you have inconvenienced us, and you have set up, you've established the Muslim employees as a privileged class who have rights that we do not have. You have made it such that we have to work longer hours to make up for their extra break time. And you have put us at a disadvantage economically by doing so. So you're discriminating against us. So the Swift plant faces a hideous choice. They dismissed a lot of the Muslim employees when they walked off the job, but now, of course, they're getting sued for that. And so the thing is still going on. But the choice that they faced was they have to either deny this demand by the Muslim employees, which is presented as a matter of civil rights and religious freedom, or they have to deny equality of treatment of all their employees. Now, it has never before happened that a group in the United States has asserted a ready-made model for society and governance that was at variance with American constitutional pluralism on a large scale. And actually, in this case, it is happening on a large scale, but only in the aggregate. It's all happening on a small scale, here and there, bit by bit, piece by piece, but the principle asserted is always the same, that Islamic law must be accommodated, even at the expense of American law and custom and principle, and hard-won American principles. I think the most notable victory of the civil rights movement, equality of access and equality of treatment, equality of rights for all people. But because these things are being done in these small and discreet ways, and by the way, at the Swift plant, Council on American Islamic Relations was right there immediately. And here again, a group with multiple links to the Muslim Brotherhood. It is no accident, comrade, as the communists used to say. These things are part of a larger strategy that the Brotherhood itself has made us know, has delineated in its own words. And so I submit to you this afternoon that it would be foolish of us not to take into account both, on the one hand, the stated goal of the Brotherhood, and then to examine, with that stated goal in mind, the activities of the Brotherhood-linked organizations in the United States, and evaluate very carefully whether they really do bear the name of civil rights and of freedom of religion that they are proceeding under, whether they really do merit that kind of consideration. One final example, the Muslim Students Association has established what it calls a Muslim Accommodations Task Force. Up until a few months ago, it might still be there, but I haven't checked lately. On the MSA website, there was a section for the Muslim Accommodations Task Force. Unfortunately, when people like Dr. Pipes and I start to call attention to these things, then they start disappearing, so I don't know if it's still there. But the Muslim Accommodations Task Force was a fascinating thing in that it directed Muslims on campuses on how they should press administrators for separate gym facilities, separate cafeteria facilities, separate dorm facilities, and all in the name of civil rights. Well, my friends, the civil rights movement was about equality and integration, not about separatism and supremacy. But these requests or demands are proceeding according to the Islamic assumption, according to the Quran, chapter 9, verse 28, that the non-believers are unclean, and thus one doesn't want to associate with them any more than necessary. Now, that is a principle I think that we can agree is directly at variance with the principles on which our nation was founded. It's incumbent upon us to understand that this is a real threat at this time, and that we need to, at this time, stand up energetically for the principle of non-establishment of religion, which I firmly believe is the ultimate key toward any kind of genuine harmony and peace in a pluralistic society, and the principle of equality of rights of all people before the law, as well as the others that are threatened by Islamic law and by the Brotherhood agenda, the stealth jihad agenda today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Robert Spencer. Welcome to Philadelphia. And we thank again the Cozen O'Connor Law Firm for so elegantly hosting us. The book is, as my endorsement indicated, a wonderful survey of this general problem. It's interesting to note how simultaneously those of us who look at these issues have come to the conclusion that terrorism is there. Terrorism is a threat no less than it was a decade ago. But there's now this other side. Stephen Emerson, who is focused on counterterrorism, is now in this business. David Horowitz, many other, Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy, many institutions which used to be looking at the criminality and violence are now ceding that more or less to the government, focusing instead on what the government completely doesn't do. In fact, the government is part of the problem here. All of us are looking more and more. You heard in the introduction about our campus, our Islamist Watch and Legal Project, which are part of this general effort. So this has become our joint preoccupation, is not dealing with guns and bombs, not dealing with violence, not dealing with criminality, not dealing with terrorism. Of course, still looking at that, but focusing on soft jihad, lawful Islamism, and so forth. I'd like to kick off the questions, Robert, by asking you to compare briefly the status of radical Islam in the United States to that of other Western countries, in particular some of the more prominent Western European countries.
The Stealth Jihad initiative is proceeding in Europe at a much more rapid clip than it is in the United States. This is due to a variety of factors, notably that the Muslim populations are much larger in Western European countries and in the UK. I know they don't like to be called European, but in any case, in Britain in particular, we see the second stage of these initiatives. I spoke at some length in the main talk about the alcohol and the cabs controversy, and there are analogies to that going on in Britain. There was a gentleman, a Muslim employee of the Tesco supermarket chain, who was fired after refusing to carry cases of beer on his forklift. Because same principle, Muhammad said, don't transport it, don't have anything to do with it, nothing to do with alcohol. So that is the exact analogy of the American case, a Muslim asking for accommodation for his particular religious practice. But then we see the second stage of the stealth jihad agenda in Britain today, because Muslim groups actually began to picket the Tesco supermarket chains at the time of this man's firing, demanding that the supermarket chain stop carrying alcohol altogether. And so in other words, they were demanding that the supermarket chain accommodate Islamic law and deny the wishes of its non-Muslim customer base. They would have to submit to the hegemony of Islamic law in this particular. And make no mistake, that is something that is very advanced in Western Europe, to the extent that there are areas of many Western European countries where the secular law is not even obeyed and is openly flouted, in whole districts where Islamic law is asserted as being the actual law of the area. There are many of these spanning from Sweden. In Malmo in Sweden, there have been many incidents in which police and fire personnel have been denied entry into the Muslim area of the city. And it's been asserted that they have no jurisdiction there, they have no business there whatsoever. And there was a notable incident in Antwerp, I believe, Antwerp or Brussels, in any case, in Belgium, when a film crew went into a Muslim neighborhood and a street vendor, he was selling shoes or something, and you would have thought this guy is somebody who's just hanging on at the edges of society. He started throwing things, throwing shoes, throwing boxes at them, and saying, you have no right to be here. And they said, we have every right to be here. We're filming in a public place. Under Belgian law, this is perfectly reasonable, perfectly acceptable behavior. And he said, Belgian law does not apply here. I am the head of this area. I am the leader of this district, and it's Islamic law applies here, and you, as a non-Muslim, have no rights that I'm bound to respect in this regard, and you're not allowed to film here. And that is ultimately what we are going to see. It seems remote that this kind of thing could ever happen in the United States, and I think it is something that will be a ways along in the future if it ever happens here. And certainly if we wake up to the agenda of these groups and head them off in time, then it will never happen here. But it's happening there now, and it's happening because there has been insufficient attention paid to the political and social elements of Islam and to the adherence to those political and social elements among the Muslim groups that have established themselves in those countries. Now they're reaping the fruit of that.
Thank you very much for another depressing speech.
We specialize in that.
I'm running out of Valium at heart. The title of your talk today is Resisting Self-Jihad.
Yes.
And can you tell us what we as Christians?
Yes, absolutely. Well, one of the title was Resisting, and instead I just gave you an explanation of what it is. Now, that may seem curious, but as far as I'm concerned, that's the first thing we need to do to resist, and that is to explain to people what it is. Because how many people do you think in your circles, your social and professional circles, are aware that any of this is happening or would believe it if they were here with me today? And this is the fundamental problem that we have to first surmount. There's no way that we're going to be able to do anything to solve this problem, to head off this threat, unless and until there is sufficient awareness that the threat even exists. And there is not at this point. And see, you know, that's the very first thing. If you were ill and you refuse to admit that you're ill and you don't do anything about it, your illness will not go away. It will just advance. And so raising awareness in any way, wherever you are, whatever you can do, that's the first thing. I don't know most of you. I don't know where you're situated. But the first thing, there are any number of ways, depending on your own talents, your own resources, your own abilities, your own time level, there's any number of things that you can do to alert people to this problem. And then in a larger sense, there are a number of things that we ought to do and should do, and I think ultimately will do once the awareness is there. And that is, for one thing, enforce our own existing laws. There are laws against trying to replace the United States Constitution with another model of governance. Every elected official swears to protect the United States Constitution. When Ibrahim Hooper, my dear friend of the Council on American Islamic Relations, says that he would like to see the United States government become Islamic sometime in the future, when the co-founder and longtime board chairman of the same organization, the Council on American Islamic Relations, Omar Ahmed, says that he wants to see the Quran become the highest authority in America, that ought to be understood as seditious language. Now, I'm all for free speech. I'm glad they told us that. I'm glad they made their intentions known. But they ought to be examined by law enforcement with a keen, steady, and sober awareness of the fact that they have made those intentions known. And then I am sure that there are a number of things that that organization and others are doing that would indeed apply as being seditious under existing laws. Yes, sir.
Yes, go ahead.
Wait, before you.
Sorry.
I might just add that the task of getting the word out is more difficult because of the three leading sources of information, namely the government, the media, and the academy, are all useless, compromised, are hiding this as best they can.
Well, they're also thoroughly infiltrated. They're also compromised by the same initiative.
So it's effectively an insurgency. It's grassroots. It's small organizations. It's individuals without having their hands on the levers of power, without having the most important television shows, Hollywood productions, most important seats at universities. These are all unattainable. They are, in fact, working against the system.
In terms of identifying the threat,
yes.
Bernard Lewis, whether the threat came from radical Islamists or the observation, the observance of the Quran, and he said it was not in the Quran. What's your answer?
Well, Bernard Lewis has forgotten more about Islam than I'll ever know, but I do know the Quran. I've read the Quran many times. I can give you chapter and verse. I have to respectfully disagree with him on this. The Quran contains very clear imperatives to wage war against unbelievers and to subjugate them. The most notable verse for this imperative is chapter 9, verse 29, which directs Muslims to fight against those who disbelieve in Allah and His Messenger, even if they are of the people of the book, that is, Jews and Christians primarily, until they pay the jizya, which is the tax, the poll tax that signifies one's submission to the Islamic State, until they pay the jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Now, that is not just picking one verse out and making something of it. Islamic law, historically, has made something of it. All four schools of Sunni Islamic jurisprudence, as well as many traditions of Muhammad, all agree that this is a responsibility of Muslims to impose Islamic law upon the world, to first invite the unbelievers to accept Islam. If they refuse it, invite them to enter the Islamic social order as inferiors, with an institutionalized inferior status that will make sure that they feel themselves subdued as per the Quranic verse, reminding them always of their renegade status as having rejected Islam, or go to war with them. This is not the province of, this is not an invention of Osama bin Laden. This is not something that was an invention of Hassan al-Banna or the Brotherhood. This is something that goes back, is embedded within the Quran, embedded in the Islamic traditions, the statements of Muhammad, and Islamic jurisprudence. There is actually no recognized orthodox sect or school of Islam that does not teach this. And so where you get the idea that this is a religion that teaches in its traditional formulations peaceful coexistence with unbelievers as equals on an indefinite basis, that's pulled out of fantasy. There's nothing in Islamic tradition that merits that. Now, all that being said, that doesn't mean, and I'm often misunderstood this way, and so I want to make sure to be clear about this. To say that this is something that's traditional and embedded and mainstream and authoritative, which is all true, and manifestly, demonstrably true from the Islamic texts, is not to say that every Muslim believes this, every Muslim is applying this, every Muslim is acting upon this. There is a spectrum within Islam and Islamic history and Islamic present reality, a spectrum of belief and of knowledge and of fervor, a welter of influences that impinge upon every individual as well as in groups in the aggregate, such that this imperative has been ignored, set aside in some areas of Central Asia and West Africa and Eastern Europe for centuries. These things were so de-emphasized that there were generations of Muslims who grew up, and if you said to them, you have this imperative to subjugate the unbeliever, they would look at you blankly and have no idea, because these things were as relevant to them as something out of ancient history. But unfortunately, the Wahhabi movement, and by no means solely the Wahhabi movement, but Salafi movements in general, the Shiites in the Iranian hierarchy, they have presented these doctrines as being traditional authoritative Islam, which is unfortunately, but here again demonstrably, a correct position, an accurate position from the standpoint of the Islamic text. They have presented this within the Islamic communities worldwide as being something that has been forgotten. One of the most widely distributed pamphlets about this in the Islamic world over the last few decades has been one called Jihad, The Forgotten Obligation. The Forgotten Obligation. And they're making the case, see, this is real Islam, this is pure Islam, this is the true thing. If you want to be a good Muslim, you have to get with this. But it's something that's been de-emphasized and forgotten so that you probably don't know that that's something that you have to do. And so they base their case on being the exponents of Islamic authenticity and purity. Now that is something that it's incumbent upon Muslims who reject this perspective to respond to. But they cannot respond on the basis of any footing within traditional Islam. They have to formulate, if they're going to, and I would be thrilled as anybody else if they did, formulate some rejection of literalism in this regard. But it would have to be explicit. It would have to be something that would be able to withstand the jihadist challenge.
So here's a very naive question. I'm an employer, and I had some very Orthodox Jews who asked to leave early on a Friday. And I say, sure. Or I'm a non-Orthodox Jew. I have a Yom Kippur Jew who wants to leave once a year early on. And then I have a Muslim who's just an average Joe, and he says, listen, I'd like to leave for Rosh. How do I know? He doesn't know what's going on except that this is his,
That's not a, that's a great question. That's a very important question. It's not a naive question at all, and thank you for asking it. Because it's, see, this is one of the reasons why this issue clouds men's minds.
Right.
Because people think, well, we've always allowed this. I mean, it's the EEOC standards of allowing reasonable accommodation of religious practices. Those things were formulated without Islam in mind. Those things were formulated because of Orthodox Jews and because of similar groups that had similar requests that are perfectly reasonable. And, you know, it might be that divorced from the supremacist agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, those kinds of requests from Muslims would be perfectly reasonable to grant. And I would say that in your case, when you talk about Orthodox Jews wanting to leave at particular times, the difference here is that that is not something that that impinges upon anyone else or inconveniences anyone else. Or if it does, then it's something that you would offer, I would imagine, to any other group in an equal way, in whatever analogy, in whatever analogous manner may be appropriate. The Brotherhood initiatives are, I think, specifically designed to inconvenience non-Muslims. And that is part of the reason why the various hot flash incidents like the cab controversy and the meatpacking plant, that's one of the reasons why they're chosen. Because they want to assert the principle that non-Muslims are going to have to be inconvenienced. They're going to have to start to put up with this. That Islam is a presence that must be accommodated. So I think the difference is that it impinges, well, the difference in the first place is that these are not individual requests necessarily, and I don't know in your particular situation, but in the cab controversy, I repeat, the Muslim American Society stirred the whole thing up. It wasn't the individual cab drivers who suddenly got the idea that it was a matter of conviction they shouldn't carry alcohol. They've been doing it for years, I'm sure, without batting an eye. And so the difficulty is that you have this group that's avowed in its supremacist agenda behind it, and the secondary difficulty is that it impinges upon and inconveniences those who are not in the group. I think that the rule of thumb is equality of treatment. The equality of treatment is a firm principle of American society that we ought to uphold. And if the same accommodations are offered to all groups on a similar basis, then there should be no problem. The difficulty comes in when, as in the meatpacking plants, the accommodation given to Muslims directly puts the non-Muslims at a disadvantage.
I think the key word here is supremacism. That is the difficult thing to convey to those who don't get this, is if it is an agenda that goes beyond the specifics of the taxi cab or the meat plant, that there is something, there's an agenda. There's a supremacist agenda. Very difficult to convince people. Very, very difficult. And why we who are making this case find ourselves butting up against a dead end. Because people will just say no. They don't see it. It's our imagination. The exponents of these tactics are generally not explicit about their agenda. You can go find a document that's 18 years old. You can find some in politics statement that was made in public, but in general they don't say this. So it's very hard for us to convince those, and you'll find if you make the case, you'll find it very difficult on your side to convince people that there is a distinction between the Orthodox Jews who went off on Friday afternoon and these cases of supremacism.
It's heavy, yeah.
Yeah.
One example on the last question before we go to the next one that I think might make things a little clearer. It is very difficult to explain this, but here's an example. In a Chicago public school, Muslim students, at the behest, of course, of leadership that was outside the school, got Jell-O removed from the school lunch menu. Now, this seems utterly trivial. Bear with me for a minute. Jell-O, it seems, is made from a gelatin that is made with pork, with the hooves of pigs. So I don't want it either. But in any case, you know, I went through public schools. I went to public schools all my life. And there were plenty of times that on the school lunch menu, there were things I didn't want to eat. And I felt free not to eat them. And there was no problem. This was not a larger issue. In a certain sense, it's silly even to be talking this way. But if you think about it, the Muslim students, all they had to do was not eat the Jell-O. No problem. But that was not enough. It was not enough not for the students. It was not enough for the Muslim organizations that were behind them. And they had to assert the principle that nobody could eat the Jell-O. And maybe somebody likes the Jell-O in there and eats it, but they can't have it anymore because they're Muslim students who object to it. And so, you see, it's not a matter of reasonable accommodation in that case. It's a supremacist agenda that asserts the Islamic law and makes it apply to all the non-Muslims in the school. And that's where I think it can be, it's clearly problematic.
CARE has been somewhat exposed as a result of information that came out during the Alarian trial. How important do you think that will be for the future of CARE, and will that have legs, or will that just go away?
Well, it was more the—I would say it's more the Holy Land Foundation trial that really has done CARE in. CARE was named an unindicted co-conspirator in that trial. The Holy Land Foundation, once again, was once the largest Islamic charity in the United States. It was funneling money to Hamas. CARE, in a particularly cruel joke, they had, after 9/11, a button on their website that had the burning tower, picture of the burning twin towers, and said, contribute to the support the victims of 9/11 fund. And if you made a contribution to that fund, the money went to the Holy Land Foundation, who gave it to Hamas. And so CARE was named an unindicted co-conspirator in that trial, and they have not been successful in removing the label. And it just came out last couple weeks that in October, the FBI, after working with CARE in an unconscionable way for years, sensitivity training, seminars about mutual understanding. They even gave CARE a tour of airport security procedures at O'Hare in Chicago. And yet in October of 08, they notified CARE that they were not going to be working with them anymore. Now, the letter, to be sure, was kind of tentative and apologetic. And I would not be surprised if this is reversed. But right now, it's certainly a major victory that CARE has been put on notice that as long as they have not addressed these activities that got them named an unindicted co-conspirator in the first place, that the FBI is not going to work with them. Now, they're very slick, and I suspect that they will be able to address them to the FBI's satisfaction, but they've not yet done so.
A couple of points. One is that Middle East Forum is organizing an ad from moderate Muslims congratulating the FBI for breaking the ties to CARE. And secondly, in my view, CARE will be shuttered. It is a dirty organization with a nasty history, and that will be a great day. But it will be followed by an organization, perhaps existing one, perhaps one yet to come into being, that will be clean, that will not have statements such as you heard Robert quote about Islamic supremacism, without contributions to Hamas, without apologetics for terrorism. And then our task will be that much more difficult. So for us, ties to terrorism and other forms of nasty behavior are a crutch. convenient, useful crutch, but a temporary one. And I assume that as the years go by, we'll be dealing with more formidable opponents who are no longer doing the dumb things that Kerry has been doing. In which case, our arguments have to be all the more persuasive because we can no longer count on them making these mistakes.
The speaker has very clearly demonstrated that the Quran itself can be construed as the original agenda, supremacist agenda for Islam. And indeed, we've seen that not all Muslims at all times, even in the current period, follow an extremist supremacist agenda. So you use the term a spectrum of fervor. Would you then say that the phenomenon that we see now is a phenomenon that has emerged with particular sharpness in recent years? As such, how would you explain this emergence, since it needn't necessarily occur, even though the agenda is imminent in Islam?
Yeah, it emerged. It certainly is a phenomenon that has emerged in recent years. Recent years being about the last 80. But
recent enough.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I'm not in the least being ironic in saying that. It has emerged for a variety of reasons, I would say, at this time. One is one that I've already mentioned, and that is the perceived humiliation and insult to Islam and violation of Islamic imperatives that was the abolition of the caliphate. The Khilafah was the symbol. By the time it was abolished in 1924, it was really nothing more than a symbol. But it was the symbol of the supranational unity of the Muslims, of the fact that the Muslim Ummah, the community worldwide, was a brotherhood, a unity that surpassed all the unities, all the loyalties of nation, of tribe, of family even. And that it was headed by the caliph who, as successor of Muhammad, was charged with the responsibility to wage jihad against non-Muslim polities to impose Islamic law over them. Now, by 1924, this was essentially a symbolic office. The caliph was essentially a figurehead, but his symbolic power was very great as being the unity, the living unity, and the living power of Islam. When it was gone, if you look at some of the jihadist websites and Salafist websites online, they will tell you, this is when all our troubles began. You can even go, there was one, is or was, 1924.com, which explains why everything went haywire in the Islamic world when the unity of the Muslims was destroyed and the colonial powers swooped in, which is completely historically inaccurate. The colonial powers were swooping out by 1924, but in any case, the idea is that they came in and divvied up the spoils and are now oppressing the Muslims and keeping them from occupying their rightful place in the world. And so the restoration of the caliphate has been an impulse that dates almost back to its abolition. But it would never have gained any traction whatsoever if the Saudis hadn't struck oil. And if the Iranians had not succeeded, the mullahs had not succeeded, if Khomeini had not succeeded in conquering Iran from France, and he conquered Iran from France via cassette tapes, and that's the third thing, that the communications revolution has made it possible for the propagation of material like Jihad, the Forgotten Obligation, and material of a similar nature that calls Muslims back to the stated purity of their faith in a way that has never been before possible. It used to be, if you were in Kyrgyzstan or Mali or some place in the middle of nowhere, with no prejudice to those places, they're great places, I love them, then you learned about Islam, you probably couldn't read, and you learned about Islam from the local imam. And if the local imam was not preaching jihad warfare, then you would not have any idea of it. Now you can go to the internet, and all these people will tell you this is real Islam. Now you can get a DVD. You know, there's a wonderful book by Tariq Shah, who is an English writer of Afghan descent. And he decided at a certain point that he was not being fair or true to his own heritage and his own identity as a Muslim and as an Afghani, but he didn't want to go back and live in Afghanistan, so he moved his family to Morocco. And he wrote a wonderful book about his first year in Casablanca, as a matter of fact, called The Caliph's House. He bought this a house that had been occupied actually by a minor local official who bore the same title as the worldwide leader of Islam. But in any case, he recounts, it's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it on a number of levels. But for one thing I thought was very interesting, he talks about the Wahhabis coming in, Saudis coming in and setting up a trailer in the neighborhood, like a bookmobile or something, and preaching what they presented as the purity of Islam to the locals who considered themselves to be perfectly good Muslims but were not waging jihad against the infidel, and calling them back to it in this way. And of course the Saudis have the money to do this, but even without an actual physical presence in the neighborhood, all you have to do is turn on the television nowadays, turn on the internet, and there it is.
I'm afraid we're out of time. As someone who spent a summer in Mali, I took umbrage. But I have to admit, there's a certain truth in the middle of nowhere. I'm afraid we're out of time. I'd like to thank Robert Spencer for the eloquent and courageous work he does. In particular, note the book, Stone Jihad. I'd like to thank again our hosts, Cozen O'Connor, for so gracefully and generously hosting us on this and on many other occasions. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. I don't know if we have another date in mind. We do. Could you?
Yes, April 6th.
All right. On April 6th here, right?
No, it's Pepper.
Sorry? At the distinguished law firm of Pepper Hamilton. We will be hosting Rita Katz. Rita Katz is the head of Site Intelligence, now been renamed. She used to work with Stephen Emerson. She does extraordinary work on the internet. She is the one who, she and her team, run ahead of all the intelligence services worldwide and find out what Al-Qaeda and others are up to. It's extraordinary. And she will give a briefing on her work and what she's learned over the last decade about Al-Qaeda's operations at Pepper Hamilton on April 6th. You'll be getting invitations shortly. So again, thank you to all, and look forward to seeing you soon again.
One comment.